Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a project of KCBX and its team of program hosts. Today, join host Dr. Mario Espinoza-Kulik for a conversation with leaders from End Kids Cancer, a San Luis Obispo-based organization working at the forefront of pediatric cancer research, family navigation, and prevention. We invite you to listen, learn, and participate in our conversation today, Thursday between 1 and 2. We're live and we can take your calls, so join in the conversation at 805-781-3875, or you can email your questions after the show to voices@kcbx.org. And with that, let's join Mario Espinoza-Kulik and his guests. Over to you, Mario.
Good afternoon and welcome. My name is Dr. Mario Espinoza-Kulik, and you're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX. Pediatric cancer remains one of the most urgent medical challenges facing families today, and the disparities are stark. Children with lower socioeconomic status and children of color have been 20 to 30% lower in survival rates with diagnosed with cancer. Our guests today have been personally impacted by childhood cancer and are leading efforts to prevent, cure, and heal from childhood cancer in our local communities. Joining me today for our show, we have Frank Kalman, Executive Director and Founder of End Kids Cancer, Taylor Kalman Fukushima, Board Member of End Kids Cancer, and Guy Rathbun, Board Member of End Kids Cancer. Thank you all for joining us.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Thanks, Guy. I'm so honored to have you in the studio and to talk to you about this program. And I'd love for our listeners to get to know you and what experiences have shaped your commitments and how those experiences inform your motivation to work in support of local families and families that are impacted by childhood cancer. So the first question is, what motivated you all to get into this line of work? Would you like to start us off, Frank?
Oh, sure. Well, it all started 25 years ago when our 12-year-old daughter was diagnosed with a really rare disease called a neuroblastoma, and when we took her down to L.A., they removed the tumor and they said that she had a 45% chance of growing up. After she relapsed, the doctors, this was only 7 months later, the doctors told us that she wasn't going to make it. My wife and I would not accept that. I started reading the medical literature, attending medical conferences throughout the country, and dragging her to see all the top guys in the field focused on her disease. We found them. But she continued to relapse. She relapsed another six more times, has had a total of 7 serious major surgeries, has had countless weeks of radiation therapy, and has probably been on chemo for 500 weeks at least, heavy and mild. And she has had to have a double mastectomy because of breast cancer, because of the radiation she received in the chest as a child, and also lost her ability to have children. Today, we found the guys that saved her, and each time she relapsed, they brought her out to no evidence of the disease state. While her battle was extremely brutal, she is now 36, happily married, beautiful, and she's getting ready for her 37th birthday. While she had a brutal battle, she was considered one of the lucky ones because at the very beginning of her cancer fight, she had made friends with 8 other kids that had the exact same disease. While she was relapsing, her friends were dying off. And when that last child died is when we decided to start End Kids Cancer, because we knew who the top guys in the field were. And so for that reason, we started raising money for them. And then in the process of fighting pediatric cancer, after about 10 years, well, even sooner, we realized that many kids were dying needlessly because they weren't getting to the right centers or receiving the right treatments, and for multiple reasons. A lot of times the doctors who parents and doctors didn't know, possibly, of other treatments available, or the doctors may have made incorrect assumptions about the family's ability or willingness to travel or go wherever it takes. So there is this attitude of, we don't think they're going to do it. Parents aren't going to get involved or make that commitment to travel to another side of the country, so they don't disclose. And there's several other reasons as well, and that is the financial, and most importantly is the attitude that is so, so important. And this applies to adult cancers too, is adopting the attitude that you can make a difference on the outcome of your cancer fight. It's just that you need to take several steps. As a result, we wrote a cancer guide based on what we learned, and it has turned out to be extremely effective. And then also, in terms of our last and most newest initiative or program is prevention. While our daughter was having her double mastectomy at Cedars-Sinai, down the street I was in the hotel and I asked myself, could we have avoided this whole darn thing in the first place? So I start Googling her disease and lawsuits. And up come all these lawsuits focused on her disease. And it was all the people that were winning these lawsuits were moms who were pregnant who moved into their house after the home had been fumigated for termites for chlordane. Mm. And that's exactly what happened to us. We bought our first house in Los Osos. It had just been fumigated. My wife was pregnant with our daughter. The folks at the fumigation company assured us that this was safe. And then a few months later, FDA came in and removed chlordane from the market. So that caused us to, I started reading, I wish I would have known that. So I started reading much more about prevention and found a huge hole in the medical services that are provided to pediatrics and children, and that is prevention of cancer and other non-communicable diseases. So we're working on that with one of the top experts in the world, Dr. Philip Landergan, whose research back in the 70s prompted the EPA to remove lead from household paint and gasoline, and Congress brought him in to evaluate the 9/11 site. He's on our medical advisory board.
Wow, that's amazing. And it brings the another meaning, another layer of meaning to the phrase, knowledge is power.
Absolutely. That's what saved my daughter, and that's what saved a lot of other kids, and you're so correct.
Do you want to follow up, Taylor? What were your motivations for doing this work?
Thank you, Mario. Thanks again for letting us be here today. We, as you know, I am the sibling of Callie and Frank's daughter, and I had the privilege of being Callie's sister throughout the whole battle of her cancer treatment. And unfortunately, our family just became far too knowledgeable on this topic. And pray God we have a dad who would stop at nothing to figure out a way to make our lives easier and save my sister. And my dad's humble in that he won't tell you all the battles he fought on his own, knowing that he wanted to protect our family emotionally. All these times that she was sent home, essentially told to die, my dad kept that to himself multiple times throughout our childhood. And it wasn't until later on that he ever admit it to us, because he needed to bury that burden to protect our family. And so I just have a lot of respect and admiration for all the work and the things that he's done for our family. And in that, watching just the horrendous impact it's played on our family, and just the things that people did for our family amid those times. We've had community members throw fundraisers for our family and advocate for us, and the incredible people that went ahead of us to advocate, to provide research, and to spend their whole careers finding out solutions to these cancers. They're the reason that we're able to be here today to talk about it. And so I find it really important to be able to make it my life's work to work in philanthropy. And that's what I've been able to do. I've had the privilege of working in philanthropy, and it's based off of this experience that I've had as a sibling of a cancer patient. And I'm just thrilled to see what we're able to do with End Kids Cancer and all the people that we're able to help and just make a blessing come out of the horrendous experiences that we've had ourselves.
Thanks for sharing that. It's very inspiring. And if you don't mind sharing your sister's name one more time for our listeners.
Yep, my sister is Callie Kalman Calvert. You can say that three times fast.
Happy early birthday, Callie. And a guy, what about your motivations?
When I was a teenager, 16 years old, my older sister, 19, died of acute leukemia. She was diagnosed in June and died in September. Two things about that that really drew me toward the foundation, because it's not just cancer that's involved here, it's the family. And something that happened to us that I don't want to see happen to anybody. The family was destroyed. It was lost. It was basically that my sister, my middle sister, and I were disowned. And that happens to a lot of families. The parents trying to deal with it cannot see the value of working with the children. And it's such an oversight. And Frank and I fortunately had interviews over the years while I was working in public radio. And I cherished that time. And several years ago, I became a board member. But something that is vital to this is, and I discovered this shortly after my sister died, that children's cancer research is underfunded, hugely underfunded. And I wanted to know why. And I talked to a doctor. This is when I was about 22 or 23. I was puzzled. And he said, well, children are expendable. There's no value there. Mm-hmm. They don't have an income. In fact, if they're gone, you save money. And I thought, God, that is so cold. But it hit home. It's true.
That is horrific to hear.
Yeah.
In thinking about how people's views on children as expendable. But I am really enamored by all of your struggle. And Guy, thank you for mentioning that this is a family experience. It's not just an isolated event that happens to a patient, but that it carries everyone with them. And so with that being said, I wonder, Frank, how do these formative experiences shape how you advocate for families today?
Obviously, the results that we had gotten is partially due to our efforts, and obviously, and all the other things that we had a good outcome. So there's a lot of things that obviously during, you're going to learn a lot doing something for 25 years. And especially if, the greatest motivation in your life is to save your child, you're going to really apply yourself. So I learned a lot of lessons, and I learned a lot of things that could be extremely detrimental to your child. And so that's what we wanted to do is not only support some of the most advanced cancer research, which we have, but also the lessons of trying to work through getting your child. First of all, this is what our cancer guide that I wrote is focused on. Number one is confirm your child's disease is correct, is accurate. Number two is find out is the treatment that your child is the most appropriate and most effective. And then the guide also shows several other things that are essential, which is changing your attitude, having support from your friends, and I could go over that in more detail. But it shows the family how to overcome, most importantly, your attitude. Try to instill in a family that you could, most important thing is you can significantly, again, increase or improve the outcome of a cancer fight by your involvement, and the research proves that. So then for families who, and the guide also shows families who are maybe are challenged financially, how to overcome those, because there's plenty of resources out there, how to get free flights, how to get to how to confirm that the treatment you're getting is correct, and then again identifying those centers that have the more effective treatments, and the guide over the guide shows you how a family how to overcome all those challenges. And this guide actually, after Lois Capps, our local congresswoman, read it, who happened to be a nurse prior to being the congresswoman, she read it and said, Joe Biden, Vice President, needs to see this. And it earned us we got invited to the Cancer Moonshot Summit to represent pediatric cancer research.
Incredible. To join in and ask a question of our guests, you can call 805-781-387 or email your questions to voices@kcbx.org. I'm Dr. Mario Espinoza-Kulik with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your Central Coast listener-supported radio station. As we continue with our show, our guests today are Frank Kalman, Executive Director and Founder of End Kids Cancer, Taylor Kalman Fukushima, Board Member of End Kids Cancer, and Guy Rathbun, Board Member of End Kids Cancer. You know, I had a chance to engage with those materials that you mentioned, and I wanted to share with our listeners that End Kids Cancer supports cutting-edge pediatric cancer research, including clinical trials, vaccine development, and one of the most promising areas of study today, the microbiome. Research supported by EKC, or End Kids Cancer, helped identify two microbes that enhance immune response to cancer treatment and one that reduces vaccine effectiveness, laying the groundwork for future interventions such as fecal transplants to improve outcomes for children predicted to respond poorly to treatment. At the same time, EKC's nationally recognized cancer navigation guide, Steps to Hope, equips families with the knowledge needed to make urgent, life-altering decisions early in a child's diagnosis. This approach recognizes both the medical and the human side of cancer, especially as it impacts families. And again, this is all very important work that you do, and I just want to say thank you on behalf of families that navigate cancer, not just with childhood cancer, but with adult cancer. But I wanted to know sort of like what were the motivations in terms of creating a guide to navigate cancer, and how has it helped families secure the most effective treatment options?
Again, what it all came down to is during the process of being involved and, you know, all these, I was on these Facebook pages and all these other, and I still am. And I would hear the words about twice a week from parents on these social media platforms. My child earned her cancer or angel wings today. And I, you know,
something I'd like to say to this, it's so important. The guide that Frank has mostly written himself with assistance from doctors and others is so helpful. If you have any member of your family is having difficulty, you need to at least look at this and understand it's not just for children. It's for anyone in any family facing cancer. Because there are answers there, you're going to find them.
Yeah. After picking myself up off the floor after hearing this twice a week, I thought, gosh, there's so many things that I have learned. Not because I learned from other parents. I learned from the physicians involved, and I thought these things need to be in a guide. For example, I can go through the.
Yes, please share some of that guide with us.
Okay, let me go through some of the things that the guide is achieving. And it's short; it's 27 pages. One is adjust your attitude from passive and to active. You can influence the outcome. And then step number two is confirm the diagnosis, as I mentioned earlier, is that you want to make sure that the diagnosis is correct, and the guide goes through this and how to do that, to reach out to other centers to make sure the diagnosis is correct. And then find the best medical centers who are focused on this disease or whatever disease you're finding, because and this is a requirement for the confirmation process. I get calls, since I run this foundation, I get calls from parents from all over the country and the world. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times, it's the most of the times the question I get is, we're at the center in, let's just say, in Holland or in Florida, and they say that they told us that our child, they have exhausted all the treatments available for our child, and we should take that child home and let him die in dignity. And then the doctors on our medical advisory board will take calls and guide families. And so one of the last calls I got was from a family in Dallas, and they told us to let our daughter die in dignity. So I said, wait a minute. And we do this. I said, I want you to talk to one of our medical advisors. And the parent called me back, and they said he's got the doctors told me at Memorial Sloan Kettering they have three options for my son or my daughter. And then later on I see that child advocating, or they were using her for the promotion of one of the drugs that saved her. And then we also participated in the funding of that drug to be developed. But anyways, it would be so inappropriate to know so many things that could be helpful and not share it.
Yeah.
And to stop the suffering for hopefully sharing information that could be effective and helpful.
Yeah. Were there any more steps in that guide?
Oh, yes. Pardon me. I'm sorry. Build your team. This is probably one of the most – they're all important. But when it comes to pediatrics, usually the team is the mom and the dad that's kind of already set up. They're going to assume they're – like in our case, I became the researcher, and my wife was the one that kept the foundation under the home. She was very good in making sure that the two other daughters that we had didn't go through what Guy went through. And she was very much involved in trying to make their life as normal as possible. But when it comes to adults, this is so important, is a lot of times adults and the kids need a cancer navigator or a cancer providing emotional support. And then when you're really sick, let's just say when adults are sick because of the treatments, they're in no place to be helping you. Maybe look for alternative treatments in case the frontline treatment you're on is failing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why it's important for someone who is an adult to identify someone in their family or a friend and say, you know, I need your help. I'm going to be not in a good shape, but I need you to help me manage my care. So this person becomes extremely important. And that's something that someone who is an adult needs to identify. Step number five, identify and utilize information. One of the two things I want to point out, informal information, I think, is just as valuable as formal. It's just, again, I advocate, regardless of the prominence of the institution, the doctor, trust but verify. And if you get informal information, trust and verify that. And then and the guide goes through and how to go through that process. One of the most important things in what I always do is I go to the main governmental agencies, NCI, NIH, and then you go to the big hospitals. But here's a rule that I think everyone should it worked for me, is every time I was reading information or results from a trial, I thought to myself, what does that institution risk if they disseminate bad information? So that's the beauty of keeping that in mind, because the big institutions that have a fortune and in terms of creating credibility can be undermined if they're disseminating incorrect information. So some guy named Joe on Facebook says that you need to do this. You know, with the beauty of that, you might say, this guy might be onto something, but research it. You know, that's the thing about non-informal information. I looked at it as it could be a shortcut. You might learn something that you may have not heard of otherwise, but you've got to confirm it. Step six, make a backup plan. You know, and in our case, I would set up several clinical trials for my daughter based on which one was least toxic up front. And if that didn't work, go to the next one. And the purpose of that was, is that, you know, the trials that she was in were small, you know, 20 kids. Mm-hmm. And usually what was interesting is, and this consistently seemed to happen, one or two, it was a home run for one or two kids. So that's what we were betting on. Is it was like driving a car down the freeway. You got a car in front of you, and that's where your child is in a trial now. But if things or the trial's not working, you're already looking for another trial beyond it as backup. Step seven, know your insurance. And that you need to be talking to your insurance company and look for an insurance advocate within the insurance company you're at. And this is pretty complex, and it's explained in the guide. And but you know, for example, if you're considering a trial for your child or yourself, and your insurance company turns you down, I had an insurance professional tell me they initially deny you and never accept it, and keep at it. And and one of the things you need to, if you've exhausted all standard care and you're looking at experimental, which easily gets turned down, one of the laws that I understand here is that if you've exhausted standard care, you can go to experimental work. And then number eight, know your finances. And then that there's plenty of resources out there. And
I appreciate you sharing those steps, because I think for a lot of people who have been impacted by cancer, they don't even know step one.
Right.
Fortunately, this guide can help people be more equipped to arrive at the battle for someone's, their loved one's health. Guy and Taylor, do you have any thoughts in terms of, you know, Frank had mentioned that there have been support for groundbreaking research, especially like in treatment or immunotherapy. Specifically what I had learned from the various resources I engaged with was that, you've supported immunotherapy, monoclonal antibodies, bispecific yes. antibodies, and CAR T cells. What areas show greater promise, and do you know why?
Taylor, do you want to address that?
You know, I am not the one to answer that. My dad is the expert, and Guy can answer that.
Thanks, Taylor.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, but genetic and molecular research is enormous right now. We're making some huge strides. When I say we, the researchers are making huge strides. But the risks are there, and it's a good idea to know where the risks are, and this is where the book comes in, too. You understand how to see this unfamiliar information. I don't have a clue about all of the details of the information, but Frank does, mm-hmm. and that's why he's written the book. There are other factors, too, besides just the research that's doing. Maybe we can get to that later, but we need to address what people can do before a diagnosis. So look at your diet, your environment, et cetera, organic foods, that kind of thing. We need to address that. Pesticides that we use so freely, we'll spend more time with that later. But that's something else to see.
Yeah, more on that when we come back. We're going to take a short break to hear from our team, and we'll be right back on Central Coast Voices.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, next time on Latino USA. A conversation with Arizona Congresswoman Adelita Grijalva. After weeks of Republican-led delays, she was finally sworn into office this month, becoming the decisive vote in releasing the Epstein files. That's next time on Latino USA.
On the next Fresh Air, George Clooney. He became famous at 34, late enough, he says, that he learned how to live before he learned how to be famous. His new character, Jay Kelly, wasn't so lucky. Clooney will talk about playing a movie star who has the fame part down, but the father, partner, friend part, not so much. Join us.
That's a look ahead on our Thursday here on KCBX. Latino USA is coming up following this program from 2 to 3. Then it's Fresh Air at 3 and Marketplace at 4. Right now, let's return to Mario Espinoza-Kulik and his guests on Central Coast Voices. Back to you, Mario.
Thank you, Brad. Hi, everybody. We were just talking about the support that EKC gives for researching treatments and how we can address the cancer epidemic in this country and for our local families. So I just want to remind you all of what we were talking about, but also just bring it back with Frank about, you know, we talked about microbiomes, and I hear there was a visit that Frank made to D.C. where he met an instrumental player in kids' cancer research.
Yeah, I was at two conferences were held sequentially in D.C. a few months ago, and was all the researchers. There was 800 researchers from all over the world focused on this particular pediatric cancer, and the keynote speaker was Dr. Drew Wiseman, and I made it a point that I got to meet this guy because he's the fellow along with his co-inventor developed the COVID-19. Vaccine that has been utilized by pharma and Moderna and Pfizer. And so in his presentation, he gave a presentation, and he talked about what he had developed and discovered is that they can use mRNA, which is basically instructions, and that could instruct your cells. The point is your cells are capable of producing anything. They just need the instructions. And that's what they were able to do, is provide the instructions with the mRNA, and they didn't have to give the entire virus. They just gave a little bit of it, which would made it less dangerous, just to educate the cell in terms of what to do. And he was saying that since he was at a pediatric cancer conference, that this approach is extremely versatile and far more, it could be far more effective, and it could reduce significant cost, because let's just say in T-cell therapy, which is extremely expensive right now because you have to take the T-cells, we funded that as well as our first grant, take the T-cells out of a kid or out of an adult, and then you have to use a virus to give it another receptor and then re-inject it to help the immune system and the T-cells identify cancer. That customization process cost $500,000.
Wow.
And he says, this treatment, the mRNA approach, is far more versatile, and we don't need to go through that customization in reducing the cost of pediatric treatment by $500,000 right off the top.
That's really interesting to hear. I'm so glad to hear about these developments. And just want to remind our listeners that if you would like to ask a question of our guests, you might have a concern about cancer or a question, you can call 805-781-3875 or email your questions to voices@kcbx.org. Yeah, the mRNA instructional vaccine method has saved countless lives.
Yeah, yes. And he's just getting started. And then the other project that we think has huge potential is the microbiome research. Several years ago, we provided research for a vaccine development at MSK. Even though our money leaves the area, what we get in return are treatments for our kids, and kids on the Central Coast and throughout the country and world benefit from this research. So we provided funding for a vaccine trial, bivalent vaccine, where they're going after two targets on the cancer cell, and it was extremely successful. It reduced relapse rates for a certain group of kids, second remission, by around 40 to 50%. And then the doctors asked one simple question: why is it not working for all the other kids? And since so then they started researching. They brought in a young gal. You're good at pronouncing her name. I'll let you do that.
Oh yeah, Dr. Oriana Militaros.
Yes, and we started supporting her work probably 2019. Because her boss, who's on our medical advisory board and who's considered, I think, one of the top in the field, was explaining to us, what she's working on. And it seems so darn simple and easy to say, yes, we will provide support for this. And so she, in the process, identified bacteria in kids' guts that did well.
Mm.
like you had mentioned earlier, and then found one that was detrimental in how it impacted the immune system. They're finding out that the gut is four times more bacteria than cells in our body, and it basically controls all functions, almost all functions of our body. And now they're starting to wake up to realizing that has a huge impact. So she's identified two bacteria that are positive, and so now they're in the process of trying to deliver it, and that's what we're raising money for, is to provide her funding for the delivery process. The same process was used by MD Anderson for adults, and a fellow who had stomach cancer, he had a few weeks left to live, and they said, we want to try this new technique just a few months ago. And it worked.
Wow.
What they did is they took bacteria from a woman that did very well, who was receiving, I think, epigenetic treatment, and it worked. So what they did is they took her stool or poop, they froze it, put it in a pill, and then they transferred it to this fellow who was a coach from Florida, and it worked, and he's fine.
Excellent.
So that is our, I think, one of the most promising areas of the work we've been doing.
Go ahead, Guy.
Just an abbreviate on what Frank is just saying. The importance, too, of this new research, it's so precise, and this is where they're working with the new medications and everything. Not entirely, but a lot of the chemotherapy has been removed from the scene. It's no longer the threat it was. I say that because chemotherapy was experimental from day one. It was never known exactly how much or how little. So it's a major change in the overall view.
I'd like to add something like, yeah, what you're talking about is her research proved the team, the Sloan Kettering team, has identified that what's ironic about chemotherapy is it wipes out the guts content and makes the immune system less effective. And then same with antibiotics. Mm-hmm. Those two really, really undermine the immune system.
And we've known that.
Yeah.
Yet it seemed like the only thing we could do, medically speaking.
Yeah. Right. And now they're figuring out a way how to get around it.
Thank you for sharing about Dr. Weissman's and Dr. Miltiades' work. I mean, this is so – it feels novel in an era that I think for me is very hopeful.
Yes.
Because I lost my father to cancer in 2013, Juan Espinosa Sr., and I had barely had an associate's degree or like was on my way to get an associate's degree. So none of this would have ever come to me. And so I'm just so hopeful for our other disadvantaged families in our local context, but nationwide, that could benefit from hearing this episode and knowing that people are making advances in cancer research, especially as it relates to pediatric cancer research. But I was really, I'm thinking about, are there barriers to advancing this research, especially having heard about funding shortages from the federal government?
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah. And we're getting closer to the target of the moonshot that was initiated by Vice President Biden at that time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're talking about serious undermining of research. When Dr. Weissman gave his talk in D.C., he gave this presentation about the power or the potential of
mRNA.
Yes, mRNA research, and then the following day, $700 million was cut to this particular research that would have gone to Pfizer or Moderna.
Wow.
And this is one of the most promising areas. It's still marching on.
And so there are hopes of moving forward.
Yes. First of all, there's an ocean of medical professionals that are absolutely committed. Today in the Lancet, I read, the British Journal of Medicine, that a big team of high-level physicians at the various top universities have wrote an article showing how this is impacting research for the purpose of making some corrections in this area.
Yeah.
And just to educate our listeners more about NKID cancer, well, we've been talking about these new these novel methods of addressing pediatric cancer. But I also wanted to share that these treatments are only effective when they reach the individuals who do need them. I had brought this up with talking about the disadvantaged families across the country.
Yeah.
But for example, access, awareness, testing, and detection drive equity gaps. So when you don't have access to that or adequate communication skills or, like, for example, language communication, to especially in our area in San Luis Obispo, we have a large Mixteco-speaking population, which is an indigenous language of Mexico. And not only that, but in our communities, we also have a rise in toxic chemical exposures in food, water, and home environments. So there's just like some of these risks that I wanted to mention because they affect disadvantaged, lower income, or socioeconomic folks that are primarily communities of color. So I wanted to know, how does EKC or NKID's cancer address these equity gaps in cancer risk and cancer care?
It comes down to, again, knowledge. For example, the idea of having to travel with my daughter across country for treatments to me seemed like a dream. Kind of like a nightmare. Like, I'm intimidated. And I had a job prior to that where I was traveling all the time. And I'm thinking, what about a family that's never flown before? How intimidated they can be. And then also culturally, culturally different communities are intimidated by physicians to the point that they can't even bring themselves to ask a question. So obviously it was, working at a corporation, I had an advantage over someone that may have had who never worked in anything like what I was doing. So what this guy points out is you're going to have to work harder.
Yeah.
That's all it comes. Whatever disadvantage you have, you just need to figure out how to get around it, and that guy shows you how to get around it.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to say that the guy that is in the process of being updated. The links are bad, and so right now it's not available until we finish updating it, and it will be done soon. But in terms of what – did I answer your question?
Yes, especially around equity and access.
And here's one other thing that I think is
– Oh, Taylor, and then we do
– If you don't mind. Yeah, thank you. You know, in answer – I appreciate your question. I think it's actually something that's been really important to my dad and the entire foundation from the get-go. My dad is – he hasn't mentioned it, but he himself is a refugee, and he grew up with refugee parents who weren't ever able to fully speak English in the United States and in Los Angeles. And he's pretty in tune with the disadvantages that a lot of these families have faced just in access to education. And I think once this was happening to us and we're going to all these doctor's appointments and we're looking in the lobbies and we're seeing these families that are having a difficult time understanding fully what's happening with the language barriers and understanding that going to different families and meeting them and becoming closer with them, really understanding the complexities and the challenges that they face. I mean, our family has encountered families that were living in New York at a Ronald McDonald House from India for months at a time and deciding whether or not they bring their other kids, the siblings, to come and start elementary school in the United States. Like, these are real life problems. And my dad has a pretty keen sense and understanding that he doesn't understand. And with that, this prevention guide is really an expression of his care for these families, because in that moment when you're told your daughter or your son has cancer and you've never heard that word before and you've never experienced anybody else like that, you have nowhere to turn and you have no one to speak to. And he was still able to find a way. And it's just not that way for everybody. And so he is essentially writing this love letter, in my opinion, to these families who are now struggling. And part of the outreach for the prevention guide is that a big, significant part of the funding need right now is for us to be able to put it in lower income communities, different language and different languages as well. It's part of our planning and contingent upon the funding that we're able to get in the next year or two.
Thank you, Taylor. It's so evident that there's a high amount of empathy and emotional intelligence when it comes to the work that's being done by End Kids Cancer. I do want to mention we have one caller on the line. Our number is 805-781-3875. If anyone else has more questions, our lines are open. I'm going to turn it over to Bill, who has a question on funding cancer research. Bill, you're on the air.
Thank you. I think we'd all agree that cancer research and funding is an important part of curing cancer. And I'm a paraplegic myself, and I really resent the fact that we spend billions of dollars supporting the Israeli war machine, you know, and half that money would have been spent on paraplegia and spinal cord injuries. I'd be walking today, and I'm sure your cancer patients feel the same way.
I agree with you 100%. I always think about what Eisenhower warned us about, but about the military. Yeah. Anyways, I thank you very much for your statement.
Yeah, thank you, Bill.
Okay. And I am sorry. Yeah, and can I make one? Has all your treatment been local?
No, I've never had any treatment.
Oh, okay.
There is none.
Okay.
Okay.
And
thank you for calling.
Thanks, Bill.
Something I'd add to this, especially for specifically for the minorities in your community. They're reluctant to speak out.
Yeah.
And it's understandable. The language barrier is horrendous sometimes. So I get back to this booklet. It would be a valuable piece to add to your family, especially if you're facing anything. But there's more to it than that. And there is the coming prevention guide that will be an adjoining segment to this book. And I think this would be very beneficial. But it will help you bravely speak for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Can I make two quick statements about the prevention guide that I wanted to share with? I think the greatest potential is, why don't we avoid this stuff?
Yeah.
And so one of the, I want to share a couple of things that families can do right now. Is first of all, kids before birth and after birth up to age of 5 are the most vulnerable to toxic chemicals, which are increasing in our environment. After World War II, there were 80,000. The production of chemicals, it came up to, I think, beyond 80,000 different chemicals, and only 5% have been tested for safety. And so we're swimming in toxic in our environment, being toxic. We're working on this and getting it into the hands of families. But the biggest culprit in causing cancer and other non-communicable diseases is pesticides, biggest culprit. 80% to 90% of the cancers are linked to environment. So what a family can do to reduce their child's exposure to pesticides by 90% is to eat USDA certified organic green labeled food, and that will reduce the exposure significantly.
Yes, and the other thing that's important, because most of us who have an apartment or a home, we have a lawn. That's normal.
Yeah, yeah.
If you go to the market and pick up a bag of your fertilizer or enhancement for your lawn, the small print in there says on almost all of them, do not allow your pets or children to play on this for at least 2 days. What does that tell you?
It's a
hazard.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we still love our lawns, and we want them to look green and beautiful and no dandelions, as Frank likes to say. We should put up with one once in a while. It is horrendously dangerous for your children and your pets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's thank you for sharing that. I did have a question about, like, what should parents be aware of in terms of the most common but least recognized risks, like what you just said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. And for example, they're starting to link autism to being close to traffic, like next to highly trafficked mm-hmm. areas, because of the toxins coming from the car and then also. It is going to be a quick in the hands guide that we hope that will allow parents to take the simple steps and reduce their child's exposure to these toxic chemicals. Hmm. And also all these horrible diseases are on the rise, and it's attributed to Dr. Landergan's research that's because of these toxins are increasing in our kids' environment.
Yeah. I do want to acknowledge that our listeners hold a wide spectrum of occupations. So mm-hmm. I had a question also about what role can teachers, social workers, nurses, medical assistants, childcare workers, recreation programs, librarians, and others who regularly interact with young children play? Like, what role can they have in being aware of these risks and practicing building an environment that's friendly for children?
Well, first of all, what I found the biggest inhibitor to prevention, when I shared this information with a lot of pediatricians, and the resistance was very high. When I first approached the American Academy of Pediatrics in Southern California, they said, we don't have the time to confirm what you're saying is correct, and we don't even know who Philip Landergan is. And so I got his resume. Mm-hmm. And his work, and it was 7 pages long, I convinced them, the group in Southern California, thank God, that Dr. Landergan is the guy that writes the literature that they rely on, mm-hmm. and so So then I was in a Zoom meeting with all these, you know, from USC, UCSF, Texas Children, and then Boston College, and on Zoom meeting with the doctors who are focused on prevention. And I said, why am I running into this kind of resistance? And they said, because pediatricians only receive a couple of hours of training in prevention.
Wow.
And because that has been the biggest inhibitor for prevention.
Yeah.
In answer to your question, Mario, for a few actual practical next steps, I think if people could be really cognizant of what they're using to clean their home, things that I, yeah. of course, the dad that I have, that was the first thing that was being inspected when I was first pregnant, of the cleaning supplies I was using. And he demanded that I move far further from the freeway than I was living. And he, for some reason, didn't offer to pay my rent. But that's not the No, the cleaning supplies is really important to talk about. If we're looking at as simple as use glass containers in your microwave, try not to use microwavable popcorn when you're pregnant. There's a certain thing that you can really benefit from, and being cognizant of the type of home that you're living in. Are you getting tested for whatever it is that your local area is known for? It's going to be different for me up in Spokane, Washington, but in San Luis Obispo, making sure that your home has been inspected properly to ensure that there's not lead paint accessible for children. And those are the things that I think on a daily basis we could be proactive yeah. about. My children's daycare, mm-hmm. we're using some toxic cleaning materials that I was very comfortable just expressing concern about, and they were very receptive. So even just advocating in your local communities, whatever that looks like to you.
Thank you for sharing that advice, Taylor.
It's interesting, Taylor, on that note. The other day I was in the market and I picked up a frozen bag of vegetables, and I turned it over to look at it, and it said microwavable in bag.
Yeah, no.
And the scream came from somewhere. And I'm thinking, we are getting it wrong to be saying that. It creates challenges.
Mm-hmm. So, I can imagine.
Anyhow.
Can I read off a couple of statistics?
Yes, please.
Here? You know, what we're seeing here, based on the research by Dr. Landergan and others who are involved in prevention, is that leukemia and brain cancer have increased by 40% since the 70s. Asthma has tripled since the 70s. Learning disabilities affect 1 in 6 children. Autism is now 1 out of 36 kids are impacted. Birth defects have doubled. Now the leading cause of death. Type 2 diabetes is now epidemic when it was before unheard of for children. And lead poisoning is still impacting 500,000 kids in the United States, causing brain, heart, and kidney damage, and may be linked to violent crimes. And then some other, and one of the last one here is early toxic exposure connected to adult hypertension, heart disease, stroke, and Parkinson's. Dementia and cancer is related to early exposure to these toxins.
Wow. And that reminds me of just the intricate role that not just we as individuals and guardians of our young generation can play, but our decision makers and political appointees, representatives, et cetera, that have a role in impacting environmental policy, public health systems, and other decisions that can reduce toxic exposure.
Yes.
So we'll just have one quick question before we move towards the end here. Of what can decision makers do that have the power to change institutional policies do to support this effort?
Oh,
well, that's just recently you probably heard that forever agent toxins have been approved by the EPA. You know, these are agents that have been linked. They fall in, they have been approved, the PFASs. And the problem with those things is you know, as a group, they're being linked to all kinds of awful diseases and cancer, and they're not thoroughly researched. So now you have the EPA allowing these toxins that are already seriously suspect, and now also they're narrowing EPA's guidance in terms of what they will disqualify and remove from our environment. So now it's and that alone, that changing, that relaxing the policy of regulation is a dangerous factor.
I appreciate your answers to that question, and we have one more minute before we end here. So I just want to ask your closing statements, just leaving our guests with a few words. What would you say, starting with Guy?
Pay attention to what's going on around you in your environment, and just on a positive note, it may not be successful, but the Attorney General of San Francisco has filed a lawsuit against 10 major corporations for the use of, wait for it, pesticides by Monsanto. Wow. It's called Roundup. This has been known for years, and we won't take it off the market, but he's. You can look this up. It's just Tuesday is when that suit was filed.
Thanks, Guy. Taylor, last word?
Yeah, thank you again, Mario, and thank you for everybody listening. It's. I have to just say that what we're focusing on after our experiences watching my own sister battle cancer is just an expression of love for the kids that are going to be diagnosed in the future and are watching and battling now. So what we focus on is navigation, prevention, and research. And if anybody here that's listening has been moved by the work that we're doing, it would be incredibly, incredibly valuable if you would consider making a donation to advance the work that we're doing, whether it be a one-time donation for us to be able to get the prevention guide in the hands of kiddos who need it, or a monthly gift. Any amount really helps, and it just means a lot to have more support from our community. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Taylor. Thank you, Guy. And thank you, Frank, for those statements.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mario, for having us.
And thanks, everyone, for joining us today. We hope that you'll tune in next time for Central Coast Voices on Thursday, December 11th at 1 p.m. with your host, Fred Monroe. Thanks for joining us.